Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The big financial reform bill is still locked in debate in Congress. Banking industry lobbyists don't want regulators to tighten their belts. Consumer advocates want more financial transparency from head to toe. In Germany, though, no such dilemma, just a ban on going naked, at least when it comes to certain short sales. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday. It is the 19th day of May. The Senate is still wrestling over key aspects of the financial overhaul bill that Democratic leaders are hoping to pass by the holiday recess. The latest fight is over the regulation of complex derivatives that helped get us into the financial crisis. So what is in the bill now that assures us we won't get into trouble again? Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
The Senate spent much of today doing the dance of the derivatives. Banks use these complex investments to hedge risk, but derivatives themselves can be risky. Now the question is, should banks be barred from these investments? Senate Banking Committee Chairman Chris Dodd offered this: create a new council of regulators to decide the question in 2 years. But then Dodd decided not to bring that up for a vote. But a provision from Arkansas Democrat Blanche Lincoln is in the bill. It would force banks to spin off their derivatives operations into separate companies. Michael Greenberger teaches law at the University of Maryland. He advised Lincoln's staff
that to the extent the banks want to open a casino, they're on their own. The American taxpayer is not going to be the lender of last resort.
Bankers say, don't keep us away from derivatives. Just make us keep more cash on hand so we can bail ourselves out. Scott Talbot is chief lobbyist for the Financial Services Roundtable.
Simple concept, save for a rainy day, set aside some capital to account for any risks.
Actually, the Senate bill does tackle that idea. It forces all financial institutions regulated by the Federal Reserve to set aside more money. One amendment would go even further. It would restore a law from the 1930s and separate commercial and investment banking. Commercial banks take deposits backed by the FDIC and make loans. Investment banks make deals for clients and can invest in risky ventures. Tim Fernholz is a fellow with the New America Foundation. He says right now, banks' investment arms get taxpayer protection.
They have any number of riskier banking activities that if something goes wrong on that side, the government is going to be on the hook to protect the commercial bank.
Government meaning we, the taxpayers. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
It might be easy to tune out the financial news from Germany today. So what if the German government has slapped a ban on what's known as naked short selling in certain risky financial bets? But the surprise move rattled financial markets around the world because of the scary signals it seems to send about the economic health of Europe. What's in it for you? Well, all this could actually bring down the price of gasoline. We asked our senior business correspondent Bob Moon to connect the dots for us.
Don't look now, but if oil prices are suddenly slipping, is that cause for celebration or worry? Oil analyst Stephen Schork says today's trading crackdown by Germany only added to already high anxiety.
Concerns are that the situation in Europe is much worse than we have been led to believe and that this could actually spill over.
The cost of a barrel of crude dropped to $68 today, down from its peak for the year of $87 just 3 weeks ago. Tom Close is chief analyst for the New Jersey-based Oil Price Information Service. He says, simply put, the markets are spooked. The same kind of pressures that caused oil prices to collapse 2 years ago could be playing out again.
Clearly, the concern is that we could have another round of demand destruction if the European contagion spreads. And right now, the trade is to get out of oil, to buy dollars or to buy treasury bills or something else that's perceived as a very, very safe haven.
Investors aren't just worried about their exposure to falling oil prices. They're also selling off the increasingly shaky euro, and that is causing the value of the dollar to rise. Analyst Stephen Schork points out, for now, that's just fine with OPEC nations that get paid in greenbacks.
This is the perfect scenario for OPEC, where you have a strong dollar, therefore your revenues are very strong. You are willing to accept lower oil prices.
But there is a downside for one of OPEC's big customers. European nations would have to shell out more of their less valuable currency for oil, weakening demand. Shork says if the spiral continues, it's possible oil prices could drop to as low as $40 a barrel. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Germany's decision to restrict certain kinds of trade sent stocks down right along with oil prices. We'll have details when we do the numbers. We heard a moment ago about the latest items up for debate in the financial reform bill. It'll be a while before we see a final product, but commentator Robert Reich already found something he likes.
Amid all the sound and fury over financial reform is a little-noticed measure that would close a tax loophole. That loophole now allows hedge fund and private equity managers to treat their earnings as capital gains and pay a rate of only 15% on them rather than the 35% applied to ordinary income. The House has tried three times to close the loophole, only to have it die in the Senate because of, well, to be blunt, campaign donations from the financiers who benefit from it. But this time may be different because of the public's outrage at Wall Street. And because the revenues raised by closing the loophole, some $20 billion, would help pay for extensions of popular tax cuts, such as the college tax credit that reduces college costs for tens of thousands of poor and middle-class families. It's not as if these fund managers perform a public service worth a $20 billion subsidy. In fact, last time I looked, many hedge fund managers were speculating in ways that destabilize the entire financial system. Nor are hedge fund and private equity managers especially deserving as compared to poor and middle-class families. Last year, the 25 most successful hedge fund managers earned $1 billion each. One of them earned $4 billion. It seems to me a major goal of financial reform should be to end practices that bestow absurdly outsized rewards on a relatively few people who make bets in the casino called the capital market. Instead, Congress is coming up with a set of technical fixes for how the street should conduct its business. Meanwhile, the nation is cutting back on funding child care and public schools and universities. Call me old-fashioned, but I just think it's wrong that a single hedge fund manager earns $1 billion when $1 billion would pay the salaries of about 20,000 teachers.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. Checked your Facebook page yet today? Well, if you did it in front of the kids, you probably got a, hey, what you doing? Or maybe, can I try that? All those photos and games and messages from friends, what's not to like? But of course, you have to be 13 to get a Facebook account, or at least say that you're 13. But Marketplace's Eve Tro tells us that starting today, younger kids can post to a new network just for them.
When I call first grader Sophie Shin,
hello?
I ask what she does after school.
Usually do my homework and then practice my piano and then I go on Togetherville.
That's Togetherville. It's a new online social network aimed at kids age 6 to 10. Sophie's used it for about a month as part of a test group. On it, she can play a game picking out states on a map or watch a Justin Bieber video. And she can post her score or share that video on her profile. Yes, Sophie has a profile with a real picture.
It's a picture of me with, like, this, like, princess gown.
Sophie's mom, Eunice Shin, says her daughter constantly asks to go on Togetherville.
She wants to go on there every day to see what her friends sent her.
Sophie gets gifts like a picture of a heart from Jackie or an e-card from Ryan. These are kids she knows in real life. They get to Togetherville through their parents' Facebook accounts. Togetherville founder Mandeep Dhillon says it's new for kids to show up on the internet as themselves rather than creating an avatar. He says the site prepares them for real life online.
Why don't kids just do what adults do, but do it in a safe way, in a secure manner?
Parents set up Togetherville profiles. They approve every friend request and can see every activity on the site. Kids can send messages like, way to go, or you're talented. They can't write their own. Right now, Togetherville is free, but Dhillon says it might soon charge for some games, apps, and virtual gifts.
You may want to get a super special birthday card or little cake. That would be an easy, you know, 25-cent, 50-cent type of a transaction that a kid could use their allowance to buy.
Allowance that parents put in their kids' accounts, also known as the Togetherville business plan. And it doesn't end there. The site doesn't take ads or sell data on kids' profiles, but it can still pay off, says Mark Blinder. He's with the social media marketing firm Context Optional.
Marketers will now have actually a very good way to tell which Facebook users are actually parents of kids of that age.
Blinder says parents may get more ads for Toy Story or Fruit Roll-Ups on their Facebook profiles. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Cuba has joined the ranks of governments concerned over all that oil still spewing from the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. The State Department says U.S. and Cuban officials are in talks over how to respond to the crisis that began more than 4 weeks ago with an explosion aboard the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig. Meanwhile, tonight on the National Geographic Channel, you can get a sense of what it's like to work below those rigs. Delta Divers is a new two-part special that chronicles the lives of commercial divers who build the platforms and lay the pipe. To learn more, we invited producer Scott B. to join us today, along with John Mosier. He was a commercial diver for 20 years before launching an equipment company in Lafayette, Louisiana. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I tell you, John, you know, watching the guys in the film do their job is really intense, you know, struggling to fix a broken pipe that deep underwater. I don't know how you did this work for so long.
Sometimes I wonder how I did it myself for so long.
Yeah.
But it was a great ride all the way along.
Why did you choose it?
Well, actually, I'm from the Midwest, and I was always fascinated by diving.
Because you have so many places to do that in the Midwest.
Yeah, there's cornfields weren't... I was surrounded by cornfields in the Midwest.
Right.
And when I told people back there growing up that I was going to be a commercial diver, they had absolutely no clue what I was talking about.
You know, Scott, I had no idea about this whole commercial diving industry. Tell us a little bit about it. How big is it?
I understand there are somewhere between 5 and 8,000 divers in the Gulf of Mexico and over 20,000 divers worldwide. It's still a fairly small community of people.
But a lot of them, it sounds like, concentrated in the Gulf.
The Gulf of Mexico is the kind of mecca for divers in a way. If you want to become a commercial diver, that's the place you want to go because... You know, the deeper you go, the more money you make.
Well, how much money are we talking about?
Well, on the Southern Hercules, for instance, they're diving to 300 feet. Diving to that depth, the depth pay that they get is over $1,200, plus their daily rate of, I don't know, over $600 or something.
So you're looking at a couple grand a day.
They're making a lot of money.
John, how far did you ever go down?
My deepest dive was just past 600 feet.
And what's that like?
Pretty much diving in 600 feet of water or 50 feet of water are pretty much the same as far as the task for the diver. I mean, you don't really feel any physical difference except when you start going past the 500-foot threshold and you overexert yourself on bottom. It's very easy for you to become short of breath, and it takes a long time for you to recapture your breath.
Yeah, one of the things that people don't think of, really, is that when you're working underwater like that, you're working under an immense amount of pressure. That's what the impact is and why your chemistry changes is for every 33 feet you go down, you're adding another atmosphere, another 15 pounds per square inch of pressure.
Well, we have a clip here from the film that shows what it's like when you are in the deep and running out of time.
Hurry every chance you got, bud. I know I'm pressing you, but we're almost out of bottom time, brother. Okay, I got it. Awesome.
You have precious seconds down there to spare. And the max I could stay down was 60 minutes, and I had 60 minutes.
15 seconds.
All right, get that basket out of there.
Okay.
You have to leave bottom in 5, 4.
Swing that crane away.
3, 2. Somehow I got lucky.
I felt almost claustrophobic just watching this process. John, you know, when you go that deep, you also don't have a whole lot of time to do your job, right?
If you made a surface gas dive to 300 feet, if I remember correctly, I think your max bottom time was about 20 minutes. And it may take 2 to 3 minutes, depending on the current, just to reach the bottom. And then you need a couple of minutes to clear yourself before you leave bottom. So you basically have 15 minutes to get down there and complete your work. And most times, there's absolutely no visibility at all. So, yeah, you're always racing the clock.
So I got to ask you about the BP oil spill. This is just too deep for any human being to try to go down and fix it?
That's correct, yes. It's just too deep.
The deepest human beings can go effectively is just over 1,000 feet.
And the deep water is at?
Is over 5,000.
So really, at this point, the industry is going so far out that commercial divers can't help out when you have a disaster like this.
That's correct. They've made some hard suits. Those were not totally successful. And as automation, as the robots are getting more and more effective, they've been what have been allowing the drilling and the exploration deeper and deeper.
Scott B. is the producer of Delta Divers, which you can see tonight on the National Geographic Channel. And John Mosier has been speaking with us from his equipment company in Lafayette, Louisiana. He also served as a consultant on this film. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the early days of airplane food.
Usually they were box lunches, a lot of fried chicken. I understand that was very popular, easily done, it could last a while.
Yummy. But first, let's do the numbers. As we mentioned, the new regulations in Germany helped send stocks lower today. The Dow lost 0.6%, 66 points to close at 10,444. The NASDAQ gave back 0.8%, 18 points to finish at 2298. And the S&P 500 forfeited 0.5%, 5 points to end the day at 1115. But with financial reform on the skids, financial stocks weren't feeling any pain. Shares of Bank of America rose 2.25%. Citigroup deposited just over 2%. And JPMorgan Chase bounced up nearly 1%. Housing stocks took a bit of a hit on news that new mortgage applications hit a 13-year low. Giant timber company Weyerhaeuser fell 1.25%, and with fewer new homes to furnish, Home Depot spun off 1%. Bonds fell today. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.37%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, working to help small businesses understand what social media can do for them. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. By Mass Mutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. A Senate committee examines the causes and lessons of the May 6th market plunge. And the House Education and Labor Committee talks about head injuries among high school athletes. What is the impact on academic achievement? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. The Tea Party movement scored some victories in yesterday's primary elections. Feels like efforts to cut spending and hold down taxes have all the mojo right now. But voters in one of the most conservative states in the nation, Arizona, sent a very different message. Raise our taxes. Jeff Horwich looks at where that result fits with the mood of the country.
Like lots of states, voters in Arizona are up against a wall. State revenue is down by a third and huge cuts are on the table. But unlike other states, voters in Arizona actually got to choose what to do about it. And they voted for taxes.
The overwhelming margin for the tax increase was a little shocking.
Especially for Farrell Quinlan. He's with the National Federation of Independent Businesses, whose small business members fought the 1 cent hike in sales tax. But they lost. Big. Two-thirds of voters chose to temporarily raise the tax, even though the state's still mired in recession. Arizonans have a Republican legislature, Republican governor, and legendary libertarian streak. So if they're willing to raise taxes, is it likely other states will follow? Yes, says John Shure, who follows state fiscal policy for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
I guess you could say a funny thing happened on the way to the Tea Party.
Lawmakers in Kansas and New Mexico raised their retail taxes in recent weeks, but Shure says Arizona is a revealing window because the legislature punted the issue directly to voters.
One of the things this trend shows is that in many places, the people are ahead of the politicians. The politicians see Tea Party rallies and backlash and say, we can't pass a tax increase.
Granted, the situation for Arizona residents was especially dire. Per capita, their budget deficit is the nation's worst. But perhaps their decision will inspire a new kind of pro-tax protest, like this one last month in Illinois. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
It is almost Memorial Day, the official start of the summer travel season, and it may be the last summer to enjoy a free meal in coach class on domestic airline flights. Only one U.S. carrier still offers that freebie, Continental. But the airline recently announced it'll soon join the No Food For You Club on most domestic flights. With that in mind, we asked Marketplace's Rico Galliano for a brief history on the rise and fall of in-flight food.
In the early days of commercial air travel, passengers were less concerned with food than they were with reaching their destinations alive. So says Bob Vanderlinden. He's a chairman at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum.
The airline industry really took off, no pun intended, in the early 1930s. And the airplanes were small, they were uncomfortable, and you got bounced around the sky. So air sickness was a problem, and people really weren't all that eager to eat.
Instead, Vanderlinden says passengers would eat when the plane landed to refuel, assuming their trembling hands could still hold a fork. But eventually, the first in-flight meal services began.
And usually they were box lunches, a lot of fried chicken. I understand that was very popular, easily done, it could last a while.
And healthy.
Yeah. They also handed out free cigarettes. So
you're getting thrown around, you're sick a lot, and you're eating fried chicken and smoking.
Right. That's air travel.
But only until the late 30s. Faster, better planes could fly higher and more smoothly. Airlines installed onboard kitchens. And in the years after World War II, the world entered the golden age of airplane food.
This is the atmosphere on a jet clipper flight. Delicious food adds to the enjoyment. It's prepared in four simultaneously operating galleys, where dishes can be cooked in five-minute ovens.
You kind of have to see this promotional film from Pan Am to believe it. It was shot in 1958. Attendants carry around platters laden with hors d'oeuvres. From carts, they serve heaps of brisket and carve off hunks of roast. Even economy class passengers get big trays of piping hot grub.
People treated it as a real experience. It was something really, really special.
Patricia Friend is president of the Flight Attendants Union, AFA-CWA. She was also a United Airlines attendant starting in 1966.
It was the very wealthy, really, who flew, and the airlines actually competed based on their in-flight service and how luxurious they could actually make it.
In fact, that's the only way airlines could compete. Until 1978, the federal government strictly regulated airfares. Every airline had to charge the same amount for a given route. Unable to offer lower prices, they had to offer better service. But when Congress deregulated the industry, Friend says everything changed. Airlines rushed to cut fares, and to make up for the lost revenue, they slowly cut back on the luxury.
And I think if there was a sign, if you will, of times to come, it was at American Airlines, where they made this much ballyhooed decision to remove all of the olives on each small salad served in the economy cabin. And I don't recall the exact number of millions of dollars they estimated that saved, but that was the beginning.
These days, a lot of airlines are cutting corners on their meals.
For the next 20 years, some airlines still tried to lure customers with the promise of bigger or better coach class food.
At Alaska Airlines, we spend a little more on our meals, and you can taste the difference.
But one event doomed the free airline meal pretty much for good.
9/11, sadly.
That's Guillaume Dessian. He's an aviation historian and professor at Albright College.
As airlines had to cut back their capacity considerably in the wake of 9/11, the tragedy became also a means to actually reevaluate all the amenities that they were serving to all passengers, primarily, of course, economy.
Toss in rising fuel prices, and soon airlines didn't just shrink coach class meals, they chucked them and introduced BOB, a.k.a. Buy On Board Food. By that point, most passengers were fed up with the quality of free economy meals anyway.
But there's a paradox that airlines ignore, is that when we get on board, we come to expect those silly peanuts or pretzels and that tomato juice. It's a way to pass the time, quite literally. And so the fact of not having access to this, that actually is a trying thing for any passenger.
Of course, the trade-off is cheap airfares. Today, a round-trip ticket from D.C. to San Francisco costs about $300. Back in 1938, the same ticket also cost about $300. You got a free meal, but for that money, you could have also bought a car. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, the TV industry's annual show and tell is underway in New York this week. It's called the Upfronts, where networks and cable operations try to convince Madison Avenue they have this year's Lost, American Idol, Friends, Desperate Housewives, pick your hit. One pilot in particular is generating some buzz. It's called Bleep My Dad Says, and it's based on a Twitter page of almost the same name. You can figure it out. Yep, put enough 140-character posts together, and you've apparently got a Hollywood script, which makes the show, dare we say it, the nation's first TwitCom. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 66 points, 0.6%. The Nasdaq gave back 18 points, 0.8%. And the S&P 500 slid 5 points. That's 0.5%. Our engineers include Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Carman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewertz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, why lobbyists say they need a little love, too.
Well, the second you get up in the morning, you're represented by a lobbyist. You go to have your toast, the wheat lobbyists love you. Have your eggs, the poultry farmers love you.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.